Hi, this is Dr. Mike Chupp, and you are listening to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. This week's episode, it's somewhat unique because it's a recording from a presentation made right here in Bristol at our CMDA headquarters last month. The content was so good, we didn't want to keep it to ourselves, so we recorded it for you, and I hope you'll have a chance to listen in maybe more than once to this presentation. Our speakers are Dr. Brett McCarty, who is Assistant Research Professor of Theological Ethics, also Associate Director of the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative there at Duke. He's Assistant Professor in Population Health Sciences at the Duke School of Medicine. He's joined by Dr. Warren Kinghorn, who is the Esther Cauliflower Associate Research Professor of Pastoral and Moral Theology, co-director of the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative, which many of our members have actually gone through and graduated from. Warren is also Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center. These two men joined us for a special event to talk about mental health and how important it is for healthcare professionals like you and me to engage right now in this vital issue. Let's listen in to their recent presentation.
Tonight, we want to talk about what is a heavy topic. There are lots of places, entryways into the conversation around mental health and the mental health crisis that faces us today. We both teach at a university, and so we thought we'd begin tonight with college students. And so the National College Health Assessment is a biannual survey of college and university students across the U.S., large and small campuses, public and private institutions, a real snapshot of college students in the U.S. and how they're doing. And so the same questions were asked of these students from 2009 to 2019. So it gives a real sense of trends among this population, trends that participate in wider trends among many populations in the U.S. So I just want to name a few of those things briefly as setting the stage for the crisis we find ourselves in. So when asked, have you ever felt overwhelming anxiety in the last 12 months? 72% of women said that they had, and 51% of men said that they had. Those are stunning numbers, just both in their absolute sense, that almost three quarters and over half, but also relative to the numbers just a decade prior. So they've gone up very significantly from 53 and 36%, but the that increase in just a decade puts its finger on something very large. And so the same trend here is found in conversations around so depressed, was it difficult to function when you were asked that? And then when asked, have you ever seriously considered suicide? This is really alarming to us all. The proportion of students who said that they had seriously considered suicide in just the past 12 months doubled over this decade's time. So in 2019, about 1 in 8 college students were reporting that they had seriously considered suicide in the last 12 months. That's a heavy number. Now, these trends are also associated, as many of you know, with a dramatic rise in the number of students seeking treatment. And so, for example, we see this here in anxiety. Were you diagnosed or treated by a professional for anxiety within the last 12 months? And a kind of stunning increase there as well in percentages. And the trends are similar for depression and other issues as well. This trend reflects two things. One, the increasing distress that we've just been talking about, and an increasing willingness to seek help. And we lament the former, but the latter is an opportunity, we believe, that folks are increasingly willing to seek help. And so, as I said, it's not just college students. So mental health challenges are widespread, as you know, among the U.S. population. So we've got 8.4%, 1 out of 12 U.S. adults depressed in the past year alone. Those aren't lifetime stats. That's just the past year. And so this is incredibly prevalent, not just in our communities, but in our families, our churches, and in this room. We all know that mental health problems are serious, and if we take them seriously, we know that they can be deadly as well. A couple entryways into that. So my work is on the opioid crisis and substance use issues more broadly. Here you can see the trends about drug-involved overdose deaths from 1999 to 2020. You can see a dramatic jump there from 2019 to 2020, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, the isolation, and also the increasing rates of fentanyl, synthetic opiate that's just devastating lives. And this past year, 2021, it was over 100,000 folks. And actually, the overdose rates now are higher within Black communities and have increased most significantly among Black and Hispanic communities the last 5 years. So this is not simply a kind of white rural phenomenon, as you might have heard in the news. It's a very widespread and deadly issue. And if drug overdose is serious, then death by suicide is just even more so, I think. And this chart shows the trends of death by suicide from 2000 to the present. So from 2000 to 2018, you have about a 35% rise in the population rate of deaths by suicide. And then a dip then since 2018, and there's not a clear consensus on why exactly that is, but it's an encouraging statistic nonetheless. But still, these are incredibly, incredibly alarming numbers. And so just quickly, you can see here that the suicide rates are concentrated among men. I mean, that's kind of striking, the difference on those two sides of the chart, women on the left and men on the right. And especially older men, 75 plus, there's that long graph there. And concentrated, it affects every ethnic and racial group, but most common among white and Native American men and women. And so what that looks like nationally, in terms of suicide rates by states, the highest rates of suicide in the U.S., death by suicide in the U.S., are areas that have higher white and Native American populations, higher rates of gun ownership, areas that tend to celebrate individualism. You can see Vermont, New Hampshire up there, and Maine. That's a heavy chart as well. And here in Tennessee, somewhere in between, you can see a darker shade of blue. These are heavy statistics. A lot of these refer to statistics and numbers, right? These charts and graphs, but these apply to people that we love. These numbers are stories of people in our lives, maybe even some of us in this room, ourselves. So one thing we want to say tonight, just from the get-go, is that if this applies to you or someone that you love, then don't give up. You're not alone. You matter. There is hope for you. And these commitments are commitments that we hope that our churches will be embodying, and we'll get to that to the end. We're saying this now because we want you all to be saying it to those that you love and in your communities as well, through both your words and your actions. And to get some of that in a clinical way, I'm going to turn it over to Warren now.
So we're here now in the headquarters of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, and we want to spend some time recognizing the reality and the gravity of what Brett just named. But what does it mean to engage mental health problems as Christians? How might Christians have ways of thinking about mental health that are maybe overlapping but might be different than the broader secular medical world around us? One very common tendency now, these days, both frankly among Christians and the broader world, is to work to locate mental health problems in the brain. Advocacy organizations will sometimes say things like, mental disorders are brain disorders. And this is done for good reasons, reasons that Christians can celebrate, because the idea is that if mental illness is treated as an illness, as any other illness, that would decrease stigma. It would decrease shame. It would encourage people to seek help. It might lead to effective kinds of treatments. And those are all good things. Those are all good things to celebrate. And as a Christian, as will come up several times tonight, we affirm that mental health struggles and challenges happen in our bodies and in our brains. So it's not wrong to say that mental illness happens in the brain. And we're concerned not to want to reduce psychological and mental health problems to the brain for a few reasons that we want to talk about now. So just to let you know where we're going in these next few minutes, for those of you that like lists, you can keep track this way. I want to talk about four problems with what I would call neurobiological reductionism, the idea that mental illness happens only in our brains or can be reduced to our brains or completely explained just by looking at our brains. Then to turn from that to four Christian affirmations about being human. And then from that, Brett's going to come back to talk about ways that churches and Christian health practitioners can respond, and then we're going to be in conversation with each other. So this is maybe the most theoretical we'll get tonight, but I think it's important to again set up, like, what difference does Christian faith make and Christian theology to the way that we think about psychology and psychiatry and mental health care more broadly? And none of these right now are really specifically theological arguments, but they are philosophical arguments that I think point to the reason to be a little bit skeptical of claims that mental illness is only a brain problem or can be reduced to a brain disorder. So I want to go through four problems. The first would be what I might call the scientific progress problem. This isn't so much a philosophical problem as it's a historical disappointment for people that have strong commitments to neurobiological accounts of mental illness. Since at least 1980, really before, but since at least 1980, when the third edition of psychiatry's diagnostic guidebook, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, was published, there's been the idea that if psychiatrists could just get our diagnoses reliable, and that would show up in diagnoses like major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder and PTSD and other things, that then basic scientists could go to work and actually elucidate the biological mechanisms and the genetic mechanisms and others that give rise to these discrete mental health syndromes. And billions of dollars have gone into this kind of research, both from the NIMH, from other funding agencies, from global funding agencies. And we do know a lot more. I'm at Duke University Medical Center. There's a lot of incredible work that's going on in neurobiology and translational research, and it's still happening. And all of that work over the last 40-plus years has not paid off in terms of giving us clear etiological explanations of how mental disorders form from the brain up, or from molecules up, or from genes up. For the vast majority of the things that I diagnose as a psychiatrist, we have a lot of information, but no clear explanation. And there's a couple of recent books, one by the historian of science at Harvard, Ann Harrington, another by a sociologist, Andrew Scull, that go through this history and how there was this great hope, especially in the 1980s, and really through the decade of the brain in the 1990s and beyond, that we would have the explanations, and we really don't. And so the question is, maybe the diagnoses are wrong. There's a lot of people that think that the diagnoses need to be tweaked. But also, maybe we're like asking the wrong kinds of questions. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place for the answers. And this leads to another problem that we would refer to as the inside-outside problem. Now, how many of you here, this is an old figure that you've probably seen versions of this before, how many of you looking at this figure on this screen see a young woman looking away? Good. How many of you see an older woman kind of looking down? Good. How many of you see that both at the exact same time? A few hands. I am in awe of you all. I can't look at this image and see both at the same time. And my brain is constantly switching back and forth. Like, which is figure, which is ground? This is a classic Gestalt image. Now, I think there's an analogy to this for the way that we think about problems in mental health challenges. This is what I might consider the inside-outside problem. Are mental health challenges problems that start on the inside of a person, of an individual, that maybe start in the brain or start in one's genes or maybe even start deeply inside the personality and are basically personal inside problems that then show up in relationships and in the way that we live together and in community and in culture? That's the dominant way that I was trained to think about mental health problems as a psychiatrist. They're problems of individuals that I diagnose, and then I dispense medications or other kinds of treatments to fix. That's one way of thinking about mental health challenges, and that actually sometimes works pretty well. Or there's another way to think about mental health problems from the outside in. What mental health challenges start as problems in relationships, or in family systems, or in communities, or in neighborhoods, or in institutions, or in churches, or in our broader culture, if the distress that's felt is actually quite healthy in some ways, or at least a true response to those problems that then get lodged on the inside of someone's experience and in fact get lodged in someone's neural circuits and one's brain. That would be an outside-in approach. So in other words, are mental health problems, do they start on the inside and then show up in relationship and community and culture? Or do they maybe start as problems of relationship and community and culture and then get lodged on the inside? These two ways of thinking are actually hard to hold at the same time. We often tend to focus on one or the other. But I often tell my trainees in psychiatry at Duke, like, you got to think about both. Sometimes you got to kind of go through both. How would each model fit? But a reductionist view of biology doesn't really fit the outside-in view. It's hard to see mental health problems as arising in our culture or in communities if we're only focused on the brain. The third would be what I might call the caseness problem, which would be a technical term, but it really is the question of, could you ever, by looking at the brain or at a state of affairs of the brain, say this is something that needs to be treated? Like, this is a case that deserves to be medicated or to have an intervention given to it. And philosophers who ask this question within psychiatry largely agree that in order to make a judgment about mental health, this is on the case for when we struggle with mental health challenges ourselves or when we go to a clinician, when a clinician is making a judgment of diagnosis, it always involves in some way a question of, is this kind of experience or behavior consistent with what it means to live well? Which means that it's an ethical judgment, a moral judgment, a judgment about human life as a whole. And so you can't reduce it simply to what's happening in a brain, because it requires a broader view of, like, is this the way that someone wants to live, or maybe what the good human life looks like? We have a hard time admitting in psychiatry that we ask those kinds of questions about what it means to live well. And the last thing, and this will end this most technical part of the talk, is what I might call the stigma problem. People often think that by reducing mental illness to the brain or to biology, that reduces stigma, it reduces blame, it reduces people's sense of responsibility for their own illness. And to an extent, that's true. And I think we have to acknowledge that can be really important for a lot of people. It can be important for many of you in the room. And it's a mixed blessing. It's not something that is always a positive thing. So there's a couple of large studies, meta-analyses that were published about 10 years ago, and other studies that show similar things, that show that when people accept what these authors called biogenetic explanations for mental illness, that mental illness comes from problems of the brain or of biology, that it is true that they were less likely to blame themselves and others for illness, so that's a good thing. They were also more pessimistic about the possibility of recovery. People, when somebody else believed that someone else's experience was due to biology, were more likely to want to keep social distance, and also were more likely to choose biological treatments as opposed to talk therapy and other kinds of psychotherapeutic treatments. And so when we insist on, like, biological explanations, it might be good in some ways, but it might actually cause people to be maybe more pessimistic about the possibility that they can be healed. Or we might cause people to be more distant in relationships, and that's not something that we want. I think to sum all this up and to close off this section, I think the thing that we worry about mostly is that this way of thinking leads to people feeling like they're being treated as machines. In psychiatry, we tend to have this simplistic way that we tend to say certain kinds of experience as symptoms. Those symptoms probably result from the body. We can cluster those symptoms together in a diagnosis. We can then dispense a treatment, whether it's medication or therapy, that's just intended to reduce those symptoms. And we can package all that in time or pills or other things. And it becomes a pretty technical, even industrial process. And people can feel like this. So this is a quote from a published article here by a woman named Bernice, a 43-year-old African-American woman in a particular study. She said, "I told the doctor I was depressed and he put me on Prozac. He put me on more medication when I don't need it. I'm not taking that medication because I was simply depressed and that was it. The doctor never took time to find out why I was depressed. All he said was, 'Oh, you're depressed. I'm going to give you some medication for that.' He never asked me anything. He just wrote me the prescription and gave it to me." Christians, I think, are called to see humans in a broader frame than this. And that's what we want to talk about now. So let's turn from maybe what we feel is wrong, what might be wrong, or these tendencies within modern medicine that might treat people as machines. What does it mean to treat people as image bearers of God? So I want to offer four affirmations about being human that I think being Christian instructs us and tells us. And the first of these is the most important thing that we'll say tonight that we wanted you to remember if you don't remember anything else. Just the deepest truth of who we are as human beings is that we are fully known and loved by God. There's nothing more true about us than that. Psalm 139, "O Lord, you searched me and know me. You know when I sit, when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You know my going out and my coming in. You're acquainted with all of my ways. You hem me in behind and before." God knows us, and God loves us. We're not just bundles of molecules or chemicals or neurotransmitters. We're not just like, you know, creatures that are just trying to find our way in the world all alone. We arrive in the world as God's beloved. God loves us. That's the deepest truth of who we are. I love the way that the Catholic philosopher Joseph Pieper wrote about this when he was meditating on Genesis 1:31, which says, "And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good." Pieper says, what does that mean for God to look at creation and to say, this is good? Pieper said it has to do with a deep sense of approval of the creation, not of everything that every creature does, but of just the fact that the creature is, the fact that we are. And he said, for God to look at us as good is to say, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in this world. And this is something that we can bank on. We can hold on to it. We can take it into our clinics and into interactions with our patients. We can hear it even when we can't feel it, when we're depressed or anxious. This is the deepest truth of who we are. And that makes a difference for mental health care. Second, this is a two-part one, we are living creatures of earth, which means that we're bodies, we're dust. Genesis tells us that we are formed as dust. We have kinship with the other animals and with the land around us. And this fact that we're bodies is a good thing. God created us this way. And therefore, it means that when we suffer, when we experience depression or anxiety or PTSD or psychosis or other things, this happens in our bodies. Christians have nothing to fear from that affirmation that when we struggle with mental health challenges, it happens in our bodies because our lives are lived in our bodies. That's something that we can affirm, and that's good. And we're not just bodies. We're creatures, bodies, who grow and who love in relationship. Again, we start the world as God's beloved, and we continue to grow and to love and to find ourselves, literally to gain a sense of self in relationship with God, with others, and with the world around us. And so, again, we're creatures of earth who grow and who love in relationship, and that leads us back to this, like, inside out, outside in, always to be thinking about our experience at the intersection of our bodies and the way that our bodies are in relationship with God and with the world around us. And so it leads us to think, like, is this something that's starting in my body and showing up on the outside? Or is it, am I responding to forms of brokenness that I'm seeing in the world around me, and I'm feeling that and taking it in, and it's showing up on the inside? This is who we are as human beings. And again, this is not a Christian book here, but one that I found helpful as a Christian in thinking about depression and anxiety. This book, Lost Connections, by the journalist Johann Hari. Hari, not a Christian, I think he described himself as an atheist. This book, he tells his own story of being, as a journalist, being treated in Britain, in the NHS there, for depression and anxiety, treated with medications. And he's not anti-medication. He says, it was helpful for me in some ways, but it never felt like enough. It helped in some ways, but it just never felt like enough. There seemed to be other questions there. And he learned to ask this question, what if the widespread depression and anxiety in our culture is not because somehow humans have just grown more sick or there's something happening in our genes that's changed, but what if we live in a culture that no longer meets our basic psychological needs? And depression and anxiety is a response to various forms of disconnection. Specifically, disconnection from meaningful work, disconnection from other people. He writes about examples of this and research examples. Disconnection from meaningful values, meaning we get too focused on things and materialism and success and not on those things that most deeply matter. Disconnection from childhood trauma. Disconnection from status and respect. Disconnection from the natural world. Disconnection from a hopeful or secure future. And Hari says, to the extent that our modern world is disconnected in all of these ways, then we can only expect depression and anxiety rates to rise, regardless of how many clinicians there are, or how much medication is out there, or kinds of therapy that are, because the problem is in the world around us. And so thinking about healing, we think about, how do we think about reconnecting ourselves to each other and to the world in all of these ways? Hari's not writing as a Christian, but Christians have a lot to say about how that reconnection and healing can happen. The third affirmation is that we are wayfarers. Again, we're not machines that need to be fixed. We're those who find ourselves on journeys. And as Christians, we believe that God created us, that we are from God as God's good creatures, that we are on our way to God as the end and goal and joy of our lives. And so our lives in this life have the character of a journey. We're walking from God to God. We find ourselves on a journey. And when I see patients at the VA, or when any of you who are clinicians see patients in your practices, like, what we do is we ourselves are on a journey, and we're walking alongside others who are on a journey, asking, like, you know, where are you going, and where are you headed, and how's it working for you? And that, I think, leads to the most useful question for anyone who's trying to think as a Christian about the work of, especially mental health care, but I would argue maybe healthcare as a whole, which is not like, how can I reduce suffering, although that's important. It's not how can I please this patient, do what the patient wants. That's important in lots of ways, but not the ultimate question. It's definitely not how can I fulfill RVUs and other things, performance metrics, other things. The key question that Christian clinicians can ask is, in any given case, what's needed right now for the journey? And that's a very broad question. And in psychiatry, my work, that might well be a medication. It often is for me. It might be a structured course of psychotherapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy. It might be hospitalization. It might be electroconvulsive therapy. It might be lots of things like that. But it also might be to get out of an abusive relationship. It might be to find a community, a church community, for example. It might be to get a stable housing or to have access to food. It might be lots of different things. And so this invites us to think broadly, not about just how does our experience need to be fixed and modified, but what do we need as those on a journey, in a journey that ultimately is toward God. Then fourth, we want to argue that we find our deepest fulfillment not in control, although that's an important thing, but in wonder and love and praise of God. Now, control is a good thing. I work with a lot of trauma survivors. Many of you in the room are trauma survivors. You know that for someone who survived trauma when life has been uncontrollable or dangerous, having control over one's life and one's body and the circumstances of one's life is really important and good. Also, being able to act meaningfully in the world, to shape the world around us, is good. So control is not a bad thing. It's a good, it's a blessing. But if we live lives that are so focused on control of ourselves or control of others, control of the world around us, that becomes the goal of our life, is just to get in control and stay in control, we're going to end up giving a whole lot of obedience and authority to whomever or whatever we perceive has placed us in that position of control. And for Christians, that's pretty much a textbook definition of idolatry, that we seek control and we end up worshiping whatever we feel has put us in a position of control. I think this is true in politics. It's true in lots of things. But it also can be true of medicine. And so if somebody is so focused on just keeping things under control, then it ends up giving a lot of power to medicine and to maybe specific clinicians or ways of thinking. And all of that might be okay for a while, but over the course of a lifetime, what we want to ask ourselves is, are we called to something more and deeper? We want to argue that as Christians, we're called ultimately to love and to worship. And so one question is, in our engagement with our own treatment, with others, like, am I being formed as a deeper lover of God and of those people around me whom God has given me to love, and of, I mean, the beautiful natural world around us, and of the places where we are? And if we're being summoned into a deeper forms of love for God and for others, then it's a sign that we might be on the right track. But it leads us away from reductionist forms of health care that only focus on, like, bringing things under control. So I want to offer one thought and then have you talk on tables for just a minute, and then we'll conclude. I want to argue that there's two ways of seeing mental health problems that are prevalent in our world and our culture. And they both have a role, but we want to argue maybe for the second over the first in general. One way of thinking is that mental health problems are individual problems reflecting dysfunction in the brain and body that are best treated with technical therapeutic interventions. That's more or less like what I was formed to think as a psychiatrist. And that sometimes can be a really useful way to think. And in certain cases, especially in emergency situations, that might be a good way to think. And we can think about mental health problems as challenges faced by wayfarers, embodied, relational, loved creatures of earth who are on a journey to God, where the key question is always, what is needed right now for the journey?
Well, I'd like to encourage you to find out more information about the Duke Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative at the Divinity School there. The TMC Fellowship offers an immersive 1 or 2 year residential experience at Duke Divinity School, and it equips participants for a lifetime of wise and faithful healing work. The fellowship is open to current and future students, as well as practitioners in any of the health professions, as well as others whose vocations involve full-time work in health-related contexts. For example, public health workers or chaplains and hospital administrators. If you'd like more information, just visit tmc.divinity.duke.edu, or you can find that link in our show notes today. I think you've heard me talk in the past that we have many, in fact now 15 specialty sections at CMDA, and this presentation today reminds me that we have actually our oldest standing section is the psychiatry section, because it's obviously an essential piece of mental health care by Christian healthcare professionals. As one of our specialty sections, the psych section strives to promote fellowship and provide community that supports and encourages Christian physicians in the practice of psychiatry as they explore the relationship between their faith and their professional practice. They also promote within the church the knowledge and understanding of valid psychiatric approaches to mental health and healing. If you'd like more information and to get involved in the psychiatry section, just visit cmda.org/psychiatry. One resource that sticks out in my mind after hearing Brett and Warren sharing today is a book that CMDA released in the last couple of years called Downcast, Biblical and Medical Help for Depression, with compassion developed from their personal and clinical experience as psychiatrists. The authors tackle the complexities of depression from a multidisciplinary approach. In this thoughtful and practical guide, they weave together scripture with science, theology, with cutting-edge scientific research, and the stories of many Christians who've suffered to help those with depression to find healing. For Christians, hope for depression lies in a deep understanding of both what it means to inhabit broken bodies in a fallen world and the hope we have in the gospel of Jesus Christ. By grasping the implications of both for our bodies, minds, and souls, can we learn what it means to walk by faith even through the dark valley of depression? Well, you can purchase your copy of Downcast today in the CMDA bookstore. Go to cmda.org/bookstore. Plus, be sure to check out the wide variety of other resources that we make available for you as Christians in healthcare in our CMDA bookstore. Now here's Jamie to tell us about the most significant event on the CMDA annual calendar.
Have you registered yet for the 2023 CMDA National Convention? Time is ticking away, and you don't want to miss your chance to reserve your spot. This year, we are gathering together in the Cincinnati, Ohio area at the Northern Kentucky Convention Center on April 27th through 30th. This convention provides great opportunities to learn about current health and social issues, renew your faith through worship, and network with other Christian healthcare professionals and exhibiting organizations. Don't wait. Visit natcon.cmda.org to register today.
Well, here at CMDA, we care about your well-being in healthcare. That's the main reason we created the Center for Well-Being, which helps Christian healthcare professionals align with God, optimize your well-being, and maximize your influence. If you find yourself feeling some of the symptoms of depression or other mental health issues, or if you're feeling burned out and overwhelmed by your daily demands, please reach out to CMDA's Center for Well-Being. You pour yourself out for others every single day in your practice, and our Center for Wellbeing is a place to be refilled. Our coaches want to help you find the sweet spot of life again, to help you find or regain what the Bible calls shalom. If you'd like more information, just visit cmda.org/wellbeing. Well, I plan on being back next Thursday for an interview with a well-known name who you are probably familiar with. And maybe you've been wondering, where did John Patrick go? Well, he's been a very popular speaker at CMDA for a couple of decades, and Dr. John Patrick will be joining me next week, so you don't want to miss it. As always, if you want to suggest a future guest for our podcast, you can just email us at cmdamatters@cmda.org. And if you like our podcast, be sure to give us that 5-star rating and share us on your favorite social media platform. Well, allow me to close our episode this week with this testimony from a CMDA student member recently who said, quote, "For me personally, I believe that there is a huge overlap in healthcare, treating people, and my faith. I believe that at the core, this was one of Jesus' primary activities, to heal the sick, the addicted, and the diseased. One of the things that I am most excited about and looking forward to with the CMDA is being able to explore how my faith can be both challenged as well as incorporated into my future healthcare practice." Well, I think this student early on in their career has already grasped the importance of using healthcare as a way to share the gospel and share God's love with those who are sick and hurting, whether physically, mentally, or spiritually. It's an encouragement to know that we're all in this together as we use our healthcare skills and our faith to bring the hope and healing of Christ to a broken and despairing world. That's definitely what matters to us at CMDA, and CMDA matters. We will see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.